From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The feminist movement has had an obvious impact on women, but what about men? During a recent visit to North Carolina, an expert from the Ethics and Public Policy Center pondered feminism's influence on men. Parents, teachers, and policymakers all have talked about reducing testing in North Carolina's public schools. You'll learn about legislation focusing on that goal. Some state lawmakers want to extend government whistleblower protections to local police. You'll learn why. And we'll look into efforts to reform North Carolina's regulation of alcohol, especially liquor. How might a more modern approach benefit consumers and the community at large? Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
The field is now set for the race to choose a new U.S. House member for North Carolina's 9th Congressional District. That's the area that comprises 8 counties, roughly from Fayetteville over to Charlotte. That area has been unrepresented following ballot shenanigans in last November's race that led to no certified winner. Carolina Journal has been following the story of this district and what went on there. Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins us now with an update. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, so let's talk about the primary that was held on the Republican side. Who won and who came close?
Well, Dan Bishop on the Republican side, who's a state senator from Mecklenburg County, won pretty easily. He almost got 50% of the vote. He got 48% of the vote. There were other candidates involved. Stoney Rushing from Union County, a commissioner there, rather controversial figure, rather larger than life. He had a Boss Hog ad at one point out there. Matthew Ridenour, Mecklenburg County commissioner, was in there, as well as Lee Brown, a realtor who ran the Realtors Association Political Action Committee and got a lot of money from that Political Action Committee. And those were the big ones. And Bishop got half the vote.
It wasn't expected, really, that anyone was going to pull that kind of number with quite a few people in the field.
A lot of people thought that that Dan Bishop would hit the 30% threshold necessary to avoid a runoff. I wasn't one of them. I thought Ridenour was running a very, very public campaign. He was, he was really active. The Rushing, of course, got the endorsement of the discredited Reverend Mark Harris, who pulled out of the race after the shenanigans were uncovered. And Lee Brown had a ton of money in that race. And so I thought that they would at least get enough support to prevent Bishop from hitting that figure. But no, he got 48% of the vote. Very few votes cast, only about 10% turnout. According to the State Board of Elections, there were about 313,000 voters who were eligible to vote in that primary between Republicans and unaffiliateds, and only about 31,000 cast ballots. So it was around 10%.
And frankly, the low turnout did surprise me a bit. I know the conventional wisdom is, well, because it was a special situation, and notoriously these types of primaries in particular really don't draw a whole lot of people. But this has got national media attention,
right,
not to mention all the attention in North Carolina. I just thought more people would want to be a part of determining this outcome, but obviously it was a low turnout. Give us a sense of who's Dan Bishop. What is he like?
State senator. He is very active in a lot of cultural and social issues. He was one of the people who was one of the persons very much behind the controversial House Bill 2, and he's going to be both running for that and going to be targeted with that by the Democrats who are running the Democratic and also the Democratic Party about that. He is someone who is a very active presence in the Senate, especially during floor debates. He's one of the few members of the General Assembly who actually engages with the other side in debates and doesn't just simply spout talking points. And so he's someone who's been really well known in Raleigh. Question is, how much is he going to be known around the district? And so that's, I mean, that's going to be Dan Bishop's big issue. He's going to run as a very much in favor of President Donald Trump's agenda. He's going to run as a cultural conservative and a populist. And so, we'll see. I think he is someone who represents the Republican Party in that district. I think that he's very much in tune with the voters there. We'll see what crossover appeal he may have in that district.
You mentioned Dan McCready. He is the Democrat in the race. He didn't have a primary, so right. He's got the nomination. He'll be going forward to the general, which is being held, I believe, in September now.
Right, September 10th.
So you've got Dan McCready there. Give us a sense of who he is. He, by the way, was in the original race from last November.
That's right. He came 905 unofficial votes short of winning the race back in November.
That was the race that was never certified due to questions over ballot harvesting, et cetera.
That's right. He's a Marine. He's someone who is a businessman. He has, I believe, not served in public office before, and he has been piling up money. He has
a lot of national interest in Dan McCready from National Democrats.
He is considered to be the sort of suburban, slightly left of center, but not too far left of center, Democrat who could win in a race that in a district that is perceived to be strongly Republican. And he has been also infamous for being extremely vague about what he stands for, other than being against Donald Trump and against Republicans, against the Republican agenda. So he was very unclear whether he would support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker, for instance, during the 2018 election, when posed the question, if Democrats took control of the House, would he vote for Nancy Pelosi? And he always treated that as a hypothetical. And then after she was elected, after he was acting as if he was going to be the representative elect, would he vote for her? And again, he was very squirrely about that. And to this day, when that question is posed to him by reporters, are you a supporter of Nancy Pelosi? He sort of says, well, she's a speaker, but I'm not in Congress yet anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So he's being very, very imprecise in his positions on views except for what he's against, and that's the Republican agenda, and gives language of unity and the like. I mean, the contrast is going to be Dan Bishop is not giving language of unity at all. So he's running as someone who's very much hard-charging, pro-Trump, very much pro-conservative, running hardline in immigration issues, running hardline in cultural issues. And so there will be a contrast there. I guess the question is whether voters will prefer clarity to vagueness, because that's what the battle looks like it's going to be there.
Interesting, too, of where the National Democratic Party is clearly moving way, way, way far to the left.
Right.
You've described Dan McCready as a little bit left of center. So it's kind of a strange situation in that he's got a lot of national support, national money, et cetera, yet does he really represent where the Democratic Party is today?
The Democrats want to gain seats because they as with any national party that it runs sort of intelligent campaigns, they will like to have candidates who seem to be tailored to the districts. A Republican in Utah is probably going to be running differently than a Republican, say, in New York. And so you're going to have this sort of situation in which you would think that candidates would be somewhat tailored to the district. And that's the way that Dan McCready has come across, that he is someone who he's been shown, in the suburban neighborhood with the trees and houses and cul-de-sacs and stuff like that. And so that's where that's where he's going to be attempting to set his, plant his roots. And so that's where the campaign is going to be run, because this is largely the areas of Union County and Southern Mecklenburg County. They're very suburban, and that's where the population centers are. Now, you move further east, you've got a lot of rural voters. You've got parts of Cumberland County, Fayetteville, Robeson County, and the like. Different voting, different type of voter. And so that may be actually where the race is won or lost, even though the population centers aren't there, is that you're going to have who can appeal to those voters, because they will make an impact in September.
It's going to be fascinating to see who comes to campaign. Will the president come to campaign for Dan Bishop, and who from the Democratic Party would come to campaign for Dan McCready? That might give us a signal of how he is viewed. Anyone else in this race for the general?
We've got Libertarian Jeff Scott, who ran the first time around and is, again, continuing his campaign. There's also a Green Party candidate, Alan Smith, who's running. So there will be two minor party candidates in this race.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. There's no doubt that the feminist movement has had major impacts on the lives of women. But what about men? How has it affected them? Our next guest addressed that topic during a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Mona Charon is Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's also the most recent Pope Lecture Speaker at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm guessing most people, when they think about the feminist movement and the impact that it's had, think about women.
Exactly.
Why should we also be thinking about how this has affected men?
It's a huge untold story. We have a culture and a society that is very focused on the needs of women, often in very good ways. Women have special needs at work. Women have to deal with sexual harassment. Women have challenges of various kinds with juggling home and family plus work. All right, that's fine. But what we don't tend to pay much attention to is that men in our society are falling behind in worrisome ways. We have now a situation where 60% of the undergraduate bachelor's degrees that are awarded go to women. A similar number of graduate degrees in many fields. Women are graduating from high school at higher rates than men. Women are employed at higher rates than men. Men are also falling away from their family responsibilities and from fatherhood. And what I'm worried about and what I think our culture needs to grapple with and pay attention to is that the decline of men as fathers and the decline of appreciating that very important role in their lives and in our society has had many, many very baleful effects. It's had bad effects on women. Girls who grow up without fathers in the home have many more problems than girls who have involved dads. But what we've found recently, what the social science tells us, and what some of those data that I was just citing suggest, is that growing up in a fatherless home is much more devastating for boys. And they are paying a much heavier price in terms of life success. So boys who grow up without dads are, we all know that they're much more likely to get involved with the criminal justice system. That's a well-known statistic. But it's also true that they're less ambitious, less likely to want to go to college, and less likely to be employed as adults than their sisters who grew up in the same home without a father. And so we need to be particularly attentive to the fact that boys need dads in order to grow up healthy and happy and, frankly, marriageable. When guys grow up without fathers, they are much less likely to be the kind of men that women want to marry. And so that's another aspect of this. It's sort of, we're all connected. You know, there's so much of a tendency to say what's good for women versus what's good for men. And what I try to say in my talk, what I said in my talk, what I say in my book, Sex Matters, is that we cannot bifurcate what's good for the sexes that way. We're too connected. Men and if we, if if women are thriving at the expense of men, or if men are failing to thrive, it affects women and vice versa. So
we are chatting with Mona Charon. She is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Do these harmful effects for men, do you think, result from the feminist movement, or is this just something that has happened because of such a focus on women that men have gotten left behind?
That's a very, very complicated question. I think to a degree, especially the early second wave feminists that are sort of the iconic, you know, Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and Germaine Greer and so forth, that crowd certainly contributed to this problem because they weren't content to talk about women's advancement. They also denigrated men and they denigrated marriage. They felt that marriage was a trap for women, and they were very, very keen to destroy what they called the patriarchy. And by that, they meant not just that men tend to have the corner offices, but that marriage itself was a kind of oppression of women. And I think that as a matter of intellectual history, that did affect the culture. It did serve to devalue marriage and diminish its importance for many people. Obviously, there are other things going on as well. The economy is changing to less of an industrial economy. We're now in a post-industrial or information age economy. The kinds of jobs that our economy now tends to provide tend to be service-oriented jobs, where women might have a slight advantage because women are more interpersonally sophisticated, shall we say, than men. And in general, not always, but these things are roughly true. And so those things are also contributing. But I do think that the feminist movement, insofar as it denigrated marriage and the importance of fathers in particular, played a role.
We could talk for a long time about what we do now that we know about the problem, but what do you see as sort of the first thing we need to recognize and address now that we know that this problem exists for men?
We need to focus on the fact that people in the upper third of our society, college educated and above, have figured out that marriage is important. They have a plan for their children, and they know that in order for their kids to take their places in the upper echelons of our society, that they need two parents and that they need fathers for the most part. Obviously, same-sex couples, that's not always going to be possible, but with the other two-thirds of our society, which is the vast majority of Americans, marriage has fallen so far out of favor that it is almost not the norm now. If you look at the numbers of high school dropout women, for example, who have their first baby out of wedlock, it's something like 67%. And it is no longer the norm for the for people with little or only some college education. So what do we do about that? Well, one thing, and I'll quote Charles Murray here, Murray says that the elites need to preach what they practice because, you know, don't keep it a secret that this is one of the ways that you can have a successful life and a middle-class income or above, and that your children are likely to thrive.
So a very important message. Do you get the sense that some people are now getting this, evidence is so obvious that people see there's a need to act?
I'm not so sure about that, but what I do think is that it very much matters how you frame it. You cannot come to people and chastise them and say, you're a bad person because you had a baby out of wedlock or you fathered children out of wedlock. They're following the social norms that they inherited. They didn't think they were doing anything particularly wrong. It's up to us to say, hey, you might want to rethink this. Here are the facts. Here's things that you might not have heard about. I mean, I quote a young woman from a inner city high school, beautiful young gal, smart, who was told, she said, I never was told about the success sequence. That is, you know, that you should do these things in order and be sure to be married before your first child. She said, no one ever talked about that with us.
The book is titled Sex Matters. The author is Mona Charon. She is Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, also the most recent Pope Lecture speaker at NC State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers believe public school students spend far too much time taking standardized tests. The State House has approved a bill to cut back on that testing. Republican Representative Jeffrey Elmore of Wilkes County explains.
I did an interview on this particular bill, and the person interviewing me said, I have been looking at the General Assembly since 1999, and they've all said that they wanted to reduce testing, but when the rubber met the road, it seems like it rarely happens. This is your opportunity to streamline our standardized testing program in the state of North Carolina. What this bill will do is use a program in grades 3rd through 8th that has been piloted. Basically, instead of an EOG process where you have a very long test at the end of the year, and in my teaching experience, I always had to deal with small groups. So I've had students before literally start at 8:30 in the morning, have to break for lunch, then come back to the test after lunch, and they're working on the test all the way until time for the bus to take them home, and we have to stop them. At that point, for a student, it's really nothing more than a test of endurance at that point. I don't really think you are pulling any valuable information from their answers at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, since they've been testing since 8:30. So these series of tests would be a shorter test that would be given three times during the academic year, and the tests run about 90 minutes, and the results from that would be average. Then at the high school level, we would put our energy into the nationally normed test, which currently we use the ACT. And that streamlines an extreme amount of standardized tests at the high school level. It also deals with local assessments. In one county, a fifth grader is taking over 37 hours a year of local assessments. That's not counting the state piece, just the local piece. And a trend that you see from the data is many times the systems that are struggling the most are the ones that are local assessing the most. So you see a trend of higher testing but lower results. It deals with that issue. And then the last piece deals with the graduation project and an elimination of that because, in my opinion, that is a pure equity issue and is putting kids that are in extreme poverty not on the same level as other kids with the completion of the project. It is your opportunity to truly reduce testing in the state of North Carolina.
Elmore's idea attracted widespread bipartisan support in the State House. The measure passed with a vote of 110 to 2. It needs support in the State Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to extend government whistleblower protection to city police. Republican State Representative Holly Grange explains.
Currently in North Carolina, municipal law enforcement officers are not afforded protections against retaliation if they report corruption. State law enforcement officers are afforded whistleblower protection. Whistleblower protection provides transparency that is critical to good governance and protecting the public trust. This bill only applies to municipal law enforcement officers that do not already have whistleblower protections in place. For instance, many of our larger municipalities already have whistleblower protections. For instance, Wilmington, North Carolina, which is my municipality, already has these protections in place. This bill not only protects the rank and file law enforcement officers from retaliation, it also protects retaliation against municipal police chiefs.
Among the bill's supporters, Randy Byrd. He's president of the North Carolina Police Benevolent Association.
It's true. Officers do not feel the ability or have the feeling to be able to come forward and report corruption. It's out there. It's going on. And we need to have something in place that if we report that we would not suffer retaliation.
Bladen County Attorney Michael McGinnis also spoke in support of new whistleblower protection for local police.
My parents taught me long ago that there are some bad things that go on in the United States of America. And corruption and theft and malfeasance in office by public officials are a few of those things. It's not just bad, it's wrong and it's immoral. I was a prosecutor before I started representing law enforcement officers, and I have been around for 61 years. And I've seen corruption, far too much corruption, in North Carolina. I've seen it in my home community. Regretfully, I've seen it in police agencies at the highest level. I once had a client in Robeson County that was a whistleblower, and as a result of his disclosures, 29 guilty pleas were taken in a huge case known as Operation Tarnished Badge. This bill has long been needed.
Diane Dixon explained how the bill could help her home community.
I belong to one of those communities that we're all talking about. One of those communities that has corruption all the way to the bone. And as a result of that, we lost two fine police officers. 50 years of experience. Because we had a town manager who was hired who decided that she knew more about law enforcement than our police chief did. So she created the most unworkable, hostile environment for this police chief. Totally took away all of the things that she was supposed to be doing. Now you ask, what'd your town board do? They let her. They knew it, and they let her. Our police chief resigned and went to work for Robeson County. This town is in Robeson County. The next person in charge then would be the captain. So this town manager started full force after him and let it be known she was going after him. Several of us who lived in the community discovered lots of things about this town manager that was not included on her application, and we brought it to the forefront. When our captain investigated one of these items, there was a mole in the hole, I'm sure, that got straight back to the town manager, and she fired him.
Not everyone is on board. Garner Police Chief Brandon Zudema explained his objections to the bill.
The concept of whistleblower protection already is addressed in many local policies. It certainly can be afforded protection through state and federal law, and we can address illegal termination by suit that already is occurring. Again, there is no evidence that I am aware of other than discussion of any widespread issue at the municipal level. And again, those protections that exist include against chiefs of police that might act inappropriately. More importantly, I would argue that this singles out municipalities, but only law enforcement agencies within municipalities. And if we are concerned enough about this, we should be looking at this across the board for all employees and not just municipal law enforcement. I would tell you, as a chief of police, I emphasize consistent and fair treatment of our employees, and I think that there is a mischaracterization in regards to what is going on in law enforcement. Thirdly, I would argue that this creates bad practices, and I think this is the point that has not necessarily been addressed or emphasized. It creates a unique law enforcement municipal liability. It increases the likelihood of litigious actions by employees that would not otherwise be filed. And it will almost in all likelihood hamper our ability to remove officers that have done the wrong thing.
Fred Baggett is a lawyer for the State Police Chiefs Association. His group also opposes the plan.
State employees do have whistleblower protection. Their remedy is the State Personnel Commission, unless they're exempt, which means the vast majority of state employees who have whistleblower protection don't get to sue with attorney's fees in Superior Court, as this bill would give law enforcement officers. So there is a tremendous difference. And frankly, the big problem with the bill is the remedy. Everybody's against retaliation, but the threat of a lawsuit is going to stymie personnel administration. It will make it more difficult to get rid of bad officers.
John Midget of the Police Benevolent Association spoke in favor of the bill.
The purpose of this bill is to avoid litigation, to stop wasting tax dollars, to resolve matters in-house within the departments. Police officers are compelled to come forward, and they can come forward and do what they're supposed to do, but they can completely be fired unless there's some process in place like this. Right now, North Carolina has five municipalities, including Wilmington, that has these provisions. All other municipalities have some level, but nothing to this extent where it has some binding process. Officers are required to do their job. They are now wearing body cameras. We have people attempting to murder our members, and they're being not trusted by a community. And when we ask, and they ask, well, can you come forward? Can you report corruption? We can't do that. That needs to stop.
Democratic State Representative Billy Richardson turned to his own experience in explaining why he supports the whistleblower bill.
I've done this for 34 years. I've represented people on both sides of this. And I can tell you unequivocally that every officer I've ever interviewed, when they're having to make a statement against the department or a city official, carries with them this incredible fear that their job's at stake. And it has a silencing effect of getting at the truth. And the purpose of this is to let officers know that the law is behind them, that good people are behind them, and they want them to come forward and tell the truth on these matters. Simply put, these officers are very afraid of losing their jobs. And this would be a way of bolstering them and enabling them, empowering them to come forward and tell the truth.
The measure would need support from both the House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina's Constitution favors free enterprise and opposes monopolies, making it well past time to end our government monopoly on liquor. That is the conclusion of a new policy report from the John Locke Foundation's John Sanders. He is Director of Regulatory Studies. John joins us now with a look at why and how North Carolina can and should modernize its liquor industry, helping to liberate consumers and distillers from government control. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of how North Carolina deals with liquor versus how a lot of other states do.
So North Carolina is a control state with regard to liquor, which means that all aspects of liquor sales are controlled at the government level. The state has a warehouse that has a commission that decides which liquor products can be sold, a warehouse that stores them, and individual government-owned stores that provide retail sales to customers.
So government involved at every single point along the process of distribution and sale of liquor.
Yes, and about two-thirds of the states are licensed states, which is pretty much how we do beer and wine sales in North Carolina, where a provider or a retailer is licensed to give those things out to provide them to consumers. But government is not controlling it the way that it is liquor.
That is so curious, John. Why would North Carolina deal with liquor one way and beer and wine another way? There must be some sort of history to that.
I think the history is there's the idea that liquor is more dangerous than beer and wine. And so after Prohibition, where all alcohol was outlawed, when Prohibition came to a conclusion and North Carolina had to decide, what are we going to do? How are we going to regulate it? And other states are making their decisions. This is what North Carolina chose to do.
Now, based on all the different points at which government is involved here in North Carolina, that tells me there's got to be all sorts of bureaucracy tied to this as well.
It is very steeped in bureaucracy. And what makes North Carolina even unique among control states is that we have local government control of the retail. The individual ABC boards are local government boards, and the stores are owned by those boards.
So those ABC stores that we see around North Carolina, there's actually a group of people, a board, that controls what happens there.
Yes.
You know, I come from Arizona, and when I first moved to North Carolina, I had no clue what an ABC store was. To be completely honest with you, I thought it was like, you know, Harris Teeter or Food Lion. I thought it was just something called ABC. And then I had to learn how liquor was distributed here, so it was very unusual to me. So why should we then modernize? Because here's the argument that we hear, John, whenever we talk about this, and you've been writing and analyzing this for years, urging North Carolina to get the government out of this. But those who support the control effort say, look, you know, if you try to modernize and get government out, some bad things are going to happen. What do you say to them?
Well, it's sort of a circular argument that I run into. The government created this monopoly for itself, and the state constitution says that monopolies should not be allowed. So the government creates this monopoly because they're trying to protect people from receiving too much liquor. So they want to control the sales of liquor. Well, in doing so, they found out that they're creating a really nice revenue stream for themselves. So whenever you go after liquor, it depends on who you're talking to. They say, oh, well, you know, what are we going to do about replacing revenue, or what are we going to do about keeping people away from liquor? And it tends to, I see the argument kind of go back and forth. If you answer one side of it, they go back for the other.
Let's talk a little bit more about each of those. So the concern, and certainly no one, no matter what your view about government's role in liquor is, no one wants some over-drinking, binge-drinking, anything like that. So is there any research as to how the way a state handles liquor, does it impact how much people drink?
Yeah, research pretty much finds that it doesn't matter the kind of control. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because really the only thing that we're controlling is sales of bottles of liquor. I mean, people have access at much greater times throughout the day to beer, wine, liquor by the drink at their favorite restaurant or bar or sporting establishment. So essentially what the ABC limits, what the ABC store limits, are purchasing bottles of liquor. So that's a very small amount of alcohol that's consumed in the state.
John, what about the idea that, well, if you change this, then you've got all sorts of people who might lose their jobs, or a city government or a county government is going to lose money that's necessary to provide public service? They're counting on that. That's what the defenders of the control system also say.
Well, if they are private sales of liquor, if they're private establishments, they're going to have to hire somebody. And so they might as well be hiring the people that have institutional knowledge of those retailers, of those distillers. So I don't see that to be as big of a concern. The biggest concern is, how do you replace the local revenues? And that will have to be done by series or decisions on excise taxes or some other funding level. But even that can be handled. The other taxes and the other state revenues are already built into the state statutes and don't depend on whether it's a control or a license state.
John, in fact, in the report that you wrote, which is available at johnlock.org, you actually take a look at some other states and how they've handled things and how they've dealt with the same types of issues. And it's very interesting what has occurred in other states. Is there another state that is a model for North Carolina to follow, or is this kind of all over the map as to what the individual state experiences really are?
Yeah, it's all over the map. That's what makes it so difficult in writing about this, is you can't point to one state and say, gosh, we really should be like that. A lot of times you can point to one state and say, well, in this area, this is probably the more free state to model after, but then they get something else wrong, at least from a liberty perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a legal product that we're talking about. It's not some sort of, you know, outlawed product.
Who would benefit if North Carolina moves forward with modernizing and leaving the control model behind?
I think local distillers would benefit. I think consumers would benefit. I think communities would benefit.
How so?
Well, for the communities, you would have more retailers being able to provide, so you would have potentially more jobs. You would have more distillers, I believe, being able to come about, and they lead to a sort of community pride. They can bring in different people coming in to check them out. Those are neat places, just like the craft beer revolution that we've seen in North Carolina. You know, I think craft distilleries are ready for that kind of growth.
And how would consumers benefit?
Well, consumers would benefit because they would have more options. And they wouldn't have to travel so far and to find, especially in some places, they wouldn't have to travel so far in order to find the liquor products that they want. And they wouldn't see their choices limited by the ABC Commission or their prices set by the ABC Commission.
John, is there an appetite to move forward on a modernization within the General Assembly? Because certainly they would have to be involved in this.
There seems to be an appetite this year. This seems to be one of those years where people are willing to step back and look at it and really rethink it. I don't know what's going to come of it, but it's been a really good movement and a really good conversation that we're having in the state this year.
And speaking of really good, it's a really good policy report. The report is available at johnlock.org, written by our guest, John Sanders. John, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.